The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Hello, I'm Julia Giambastiani. On this morning's Campus Voices, we are pleased to present an interview host Matt Hewitt recorded with James Baldwin on Veterans Day, November 11, 2016. Mr. Baldwin was one of the veterans selected to present a wreath during a ceremony at the World War II Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. During World War II, Baldwin was a mortarman in the 784th Tank Battalion, an all-black unit. After the war, he had a distinguished career in which he served as EEO advisor to the mayor of Washington, D.C. It's a fascinating interview that gives perspective on race relations in the 1940s and today. Here's Matt with James Baldwin for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Good morning, Dr. Baldwin.
Good morning. Good morning.
Could you tell us a little bit about how life was before you joined the Army? Where did you grow up? What was the circumstances? And then how did you get into the Army?
I graduated from high school in 1942. I entered college, Fayetteville State University, as a freshman in September 42. October 42, I joined what was called the Enlisted Reserve Corps. Enlisted Reserve Corps, we call it ERC. And the purpose of that corps was to keep you out of the service for 4 years until you graduated from college. But in December 1942, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt issued a proclamation calling all the reserves in, and you were to report for duty at the end of your semester or quarter. My college was on a quarter system, so in March, which was the end of it, March 1943, I was inducted into the Army of the United States and had to report to Fort Benning, Georgia. I got to Fort Benning, Georgia, stayed a couple of weeks taking tests, trying to classify us, and in May of 43, I was transferred to Camp Hood, or Fort Hood, which is in Kentucky. And there I was to undergo 16 weeks of basic training. All armored, you had to learn to drive the tanks, the trucks, the motorcycles, everything during your training. At the end of that training, I was transferred to 784th Tank Battalion, which was located in Camp Claiborne, Louisiana. We stayed in Louisiana for about 3 or 4 months, and then the unit was transferred to Camp Hood, which is now Fort Hood, Texas. So we stayed there 18 months getting ready for overseas duty. We shipped out and arrived, it was about November, I guess now, because we arrived in France in December, just prior to Christmas. We actually saw our first day of combat was February in 1945. We were assigned to the ETO, European Theater of Operation, and also attached to a infantry division, which the 35th Infantry Division, which we went and fought war with the 35th Infantry Division. I had, I guess, roughly about 30 days of combat, actually combat, and then the war was over. In 1945, I think, yes, 1945, you had to have enough points to go to the Pacific because the war was still going on in the Pacific. So I didn't have those points to go there. So they kept me in Europe for the next 11 months during different duties. I was on the police force. I was in a transportation unit that transferred us to Sweden, Czechoslovakia. And finally, in March 1946, I was discharged from the Army at Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
When you first went into the Army, the times were a little bit different back then.
Everything, I'm from North Carolina, but everything was segregated as far as the school system, everything, housing, everything. So the Army also was segregated during that period, you see, so the black troops were assigned separately. And President Truman, who succeeded President Roosevelt, integrated the Army, but it was pretty rough. And having come from North Carolina, I was used to the segregation. But for some reason, I felt that you're in the Army, you're being prepared for your to fight war for your country. Things would have been different. You know, the Army shouldn't have been segregated, but it was. Just different than night and day how we were treated. I refer them to black, but back in the day we were called colored. The colored soldiers was assigned a different, we'll use Camp Claiborne as a good example. At Camp Claiborne, where we stayed, I say, about 4 or 5 months, everything naturally was segregated. But when I discovered, and by the way, I was 18 years old, I hadn't even had my 19th birthday. So when I discovered the big difference, when we went to the theater, to the movie house, the blacks' theater didn't have any, and you know, we'll refer to it that the floor is what most buildings had. We sat with our feet right down in the dirt. Our seats didn't have any backs to them. And I just figured, naturally, I hadn't seen any of the white facilities, but I knew it would be much better than where we were. So one day they had to take us on the white side to be trained because the auditorium wasn't large enough over in the black area. And then I've discovered they had air conditioned, nice soft seats and that type of thing. And one thing I didn't quite understand being 18, almost 19, was that when a black unit shipped out, meaning was transferred to another state, preparing to go overseas, for some reason, they would destroy all our facilities. In other words, to tear up our little barracks, we had what is called the, any little social thing we had, so it would take about 4 or 5 months to get all that straight. But then that's, if then moving forward a little, when we had when Martin Luther King was killed, and they had the riots all over the country, then I compared that with that also, because we, meaning the black or the colored folks, tend to still destroy your own place. Like in Washington, D.C., they just tear up the little places we had to go to thing, but it was all black, so the white really didn't suffer. So that's kind of typical of what happened on a segregated outfit.
During training, Joe Wilson had written several books about the black armored units' experiences, and as I understand it, during training there was there were quite a bit of actual fights between blacks and whites and race riots, many difficulties if you tried to go off post and into the local towns.
Yes, especially prior to, as I told you, I arrived in Camp Claiborne, Louisiana in May or June 1943. Yeah, 1943. Prior to that, they'd had a race riot in the town that's called Alexandria, Louisiana. And a lot of the scars were still there. But during that training that we ran into a lot of stuff, because if you can imagine, a battalion has about 900 soldiers, 800 to 900 soldiers. Well, you had three black battalions on base, so you know that's 3 times 9, that's about 3,000 black soldiers. Tankers, so naturally they were more than that in on the base. So when you got ready to go in town, that little town was Alexandria, Louisiana, it was a public bus. So only 5 soldiers, and a bus would carry about 50 people, and only 5 soldiers, black soldiers, could get in, and we had to sit on that last seat. So it would take forever for just that 20 people want to go into town, 20 black soldiers, so that would take several hours for them to get into town. And how it kind of changed things, Jackie Robinson, which I knew then as a football player, I knew he was a football player in California, and he came to 761st Tank Battalion. As I understand it, he was transferred there from a cavalry outfit. I'm not sure of that, but everybody said that's how he came. And he was a second lieutenant, so he was assigned to 761st Tank Battalion. And one Saturday we were en route into town, and Jackie had only been on the base 72 hours. So he came and saw he was going to go into town like all soldiers would want to go into town. And he got a megaphone and stood on a keg like and say, "All you colored soldiers, all you soldiers, get out of line." So I was with my buddies, about four or five of us, and we wanted to get in town. We said, "What is he talking about, get out of line?" And he kept talking about how degrading it was for blacks to go into town. He says, "Get out of line, you can go in town, get a cab," and the cab was $1.25 to get in town. "And you might be late," he made a little joke out of it, "you might be late seeing your little baby in there, but you'll get there at least by midnight." And so that's how I met Jackie Robinson. And that just shows some of the discrimination was going on. Now, once we got into combat, it was still going on as far as discrimination. We would fight on an average maybe 10 days and come back behind the lines for about 10 or 15 days. So we would go into town. And the nearest place we could go was, and I can't try to think of the little town in Belgium, but we would go there. And once we got there in town, we had to fight the white soldiers. Now, I'm not exaggerating. The white soldiers were saying we had tails, and things was kind of segregated. There were certain bars and restaurants. They went, and we went to different ones. But invariably, we did end up fighting one that comes to mind one Saturday, about 2:30 p.m. We had gotten into town, and I didn't witness what started it, but the fight began between black and whites. And so the rule back in those days was the highest officer who was available and could be recognized was supposed to take care of the stuff. And so once it started going on, a full colonel got all of us into a large auditorium. He wanted to hear what we had to say and what caused it and why couldn't get along. And so you got black and whites in there, and they're pushing and shoving each other, so that was still going on. And then the colonel decided to get some feedback and get some comments from both black and whites. And he said, "One black, one white." And I never will forget one white soldier was saying what was going on and how he saw the situation. He said, "They over here going with our girl." And so we just laughed, "Our girl, these are Belgian girls." But the colonel should have known better, I think. Keep in mind, I was just 19 then. But the colonel says, "Okay, corporal," speaking to the white soldier, "I know what you mean or how you feel." And then the fight started all over again. Because we say, "Here we are, and you got the highest ranking person, and he is, going along with all this discrimination and so forth."
We just left the World War II Memorial Center here in Washington, D.C. on Veterans Day. Could you tell us a little bit about your feelings on today?
Yes, somewhat mixed feelings when I got there, and I was reflecting back on my Army days, my combat days and everything, and the friends that I left over there, and especially guys from my company. But as I sat there and started thinking, I cheered up a little, because it's just great to be here and see so many people who are sincere in honoring our veterans. And they would come up, even some young kids, ages 7 and 9, they weren't forced up, they just walked right and shook my hand and everything. And that really made my day.
Today you've had at least, what, 2 or 3 different networks interviewing
you? 3 or 4 different networks, yes. That cheered me up too also, to say these are people who are going to pass the word and get my feeling about this day and so forth.
Let's go back a little bit earlier, because we've been talking about your service in the European theater. And then after the war ended, were you able to take advantage of any GI benefits?
Yes, I got out the Army in March, to be exact, March the 15th, 1946. And I enrolled under the GI Bill at Howard University, September 46. And while there at Howard, I got a bachelor's degree in psychology and a master's degree in social work. And then later on, after I worked for the district government about 7-8 years, I then got my doctorate degree in public administration. Oh yeah, some of the jobs I had after that period, I was director of a couple of agencies in the district government. One was Citizens Information Service. And then when we got our first black mayor, Walter Washington, he appointed me to head up one of his cabinets. And that was the DC Office of Human Rights. And that was an area I always had some interest in, investigating EO complaints and be sure that people got justice from discrimination, that type of thing. Once I retired from that after 12 years, then I went into my own business in agency Baldwin and Associates. And what I did then was to investigate EEO complaints throughout the country. I had a staff, and that went on to 2006. And then I retired fully from everything. Still done some volunteer work and served on some boards that, and yeah, a couple of them I was paid because it's called Judicial Nominations Commission. That's the board that appoints all judges to the Superior Court in D.C., and which was the formerly Court of General Session. So my staff had to investigate those people who wanted to be judges. In fact, last Friday, I went to one retired, and he had invited me there. So I did a lot of that type of work after I retired from the Army, from the district government. I also was heading up an agency. It wasn't an agency, but it was a commission that had to, where people appeal traffic tickets. And I was the director of that for about 6 years. And we just met probably two times a week. And that was another position that I had and bring me fond memories.
Was there a time when you were working with a correctional institute?
Oh yes, how did I forget that? As soon as I got my master's degree in social work, my first job was a counselor at an institution that housed felons. And I did that for 5 years, counselor, testing, psychological testing, that type of thing. And following that, then I became a supervisor probation officer. Yeah, that's a very important part of my life. I'm glad you reminded me of that, because I still think of the people that I had impacted on their lives, because you see people on the street, Mr. Bauer, you're my probation, all those kinds of things, you know. So I think I've had a very productive, and as far as my career is concerned, I was always involved in something that I really liked. I never had a job I didn't like because I was helping people, and I'm sure that's why I got into social work.
Well, it's a blessing that you have been able to do that and help others. What are your opinions on the penal system, the correctional institutes? What improvements do you think need to happen to reduce recurring crime and criminals?
I still feel, and I feel very strongly, that they can be rehabilitated. Some people went back in the day when I was meeting in the 50s, and our director of the Department of Correction used to say, oh, they'll be back. You can't, nothing new. He says, a hole in the institution. In other words, he felt that just a place, just you just lock them up because they aren't going to respond to social workers and counseling, that type of thing. But lately they have put more interest in the correction that, yes, we can help people. Sure, there's some of them going to go back and violate their probation, their parole. But to me, if you only help 10 out of 100, that's better than nothing.
And what can we do, in your opinion, to help reduce crime in the first place?
I believe education is the key to all of that. I really do that. If you look at the communities, first thing you say, well, where are most of the crime committed? Well, most of the crime is committed in the areas where they're in housing, public housing, that their parents didn't get a chance to go to school. And then you say, well, now let's take a look, if you were comparing, so let's take a look at those kids who finished high school and so forth and so on. they get jobs, and so jobs has something to do with it. And also at home, a lot of them are single family kind of thing, and the mothers at work, and they don't have anybody in the household to help them with the homeworks and a lot of things like that. So I've seen a lot of improvement, especially in the D.C. government system. We have, I guess for the last 10 years, the scores have risen from, say, in math and that type of thing, about three or four, say, on an average of fourth grade up to about seven, and the English was going up about 10. So things are improving in D.C., school system and that type of thing. The charter schools, I think, have been a terrific help, and about 40% of the students in D.C. are in charter schools, and charter schools is where the community has more, I won't say control, but more involvement. They can do hiring and find teachers just like as if they were in the public school system, and they tend to have a smaller classroom than the public school. But we have to continue to work hard. We have to continue to try to improve the school system. And I think community colleges, see, they didn't have a community college when I was coming along. Now, you got a lot of community colleges, which those kids can't go to a typical academic college, and they have trades and those things. But we've made progress, but there's still we have a long way to go in that area of education and improving our school system.
In a similar vein, you have seen and experienced a ton of racism and segregation in your life. Mm-hmm. You've had to fight for the right to even be a soldier. Mm-hmm. You know, went through civil rights. Mm-hmm. And of course, after this latest election, there's a lot of tension and a lot of racism. Mm-hmm. In your opinion, Dr. Baldwin, what does America need to do?
I think first now, everything is so divided. We got to get together now. First I'll say, and I don't mind saying, I'm a Democrat, and I've always worked hard for that, but we have a Republican president now. And I believe in respecting the position of the presidency. Now, I know it's Trump, and people will say, well, how can you be satisfied? I said, well, no, I'm not satisfied, but that's the position I respect. I don't respect the person in that position. And we just need to wait and see what will happen. Most people don't think he'll change, but I said, well, let's just wait and see what kind of policies they come up with and how they work it out. So I've always believed in the position of the president. So I said, sure, we've had, as I say, I'm old enough to know how many presidents from Hoover on up to Trump. And so you had the different varieties in there, Democrats, Republicans, and so forth. And I've always said, and I was taught, respect the position of the president. He is our president. He is our chief of command and being a veteran. We believe in command, so that's our chief, but we got to work with him, and we can see we going to see how he's going to do, what will he do. Some people say, well, Trump isn't going to change, but I say I always give respect to the position. He is the chief of staff of all the services and everything. That we can't change, and so let's just see. I was listening at Senator Warren last night, and I like her approach. Senator Warren said, we got to continue fighting and look at the things that he'll do. If you see anything that he's done great, you got to support him. If it's something he isn't great, and if he does some of the things that he said he would do, and he's going to be Mr. Big and all of those kinds of things, then you're going to fight as well as we can to correct things. And that's my position also.
What can we do as individual citizens? Because, as you said, you know, we're divided, and the media has really contributed to that division and stirring up the pot. So as individual citizens, how can we come together again, in your opinion?
I think by association and getting together and actually admit. I remember where I live now, I moved there in the 60s, and so it was a neighborhood that was predominantly white. In fact, 99% white, because I was one of the first black moot in that. So we tried several things. One, initially we would, my wife and I would visit a white couple on the weekend and vice versa. And we really found out that didn't work. It did some good, but that's not the answer to the racial problem, that kind of stuff, because we as blacks, we made some errors in going in the white, and sometimes seemed like we were competitive, and then the whites would come in your home and say, oh, I didn't know you lived like this, or those kinds of things. So that's not really the answer just by mingling, but I think one-on-one, you know, intermarriage helps, all of that helps. But we got to get over this where we are now, and it's going to take some time because people just didn't like Trump and the kinds of things he did and all of that. But he's our president now, and will be for the next 4 years. So work with him when he comes up with the kinds of program. Now we know, at least I know, there'll be no increases of taxes, and they're going to be decreases in taxes. And it's going to be, I think, probably for the, is Bernie Sanders said that 1%, that's where the problem is with that. And so you're going to still have that 1% of the millionaires, billionaires, and whatever. But let's just try to work together in any way we can. We got to, as I said, we divide it now, but let's not just be negative and think that we can't do something, and I think we can. It'll be a slow process, but I think we'll heal it and get back to where we were, say, 10 or 15 years ago, as far as race relations is concerned.
To the listeners that don't know you and understand that I'm chatting with a 92-year-old World War II veteran, mm-hmm. a man who's done so many different things in his life and served his country in so many different ways, what would you like to say to the listeners?
I would like for the listeners to understand, and especially right now, because people are still, and they'll probably do it tonight, parade the streets and dine with Trump and all that type of thing. And that will go away. We'll heal within the next 2 or 3 weeks. And then really, really work together with the president now, if he'll allow us to, one-on-one, your neighbors talk to over the fence to, you know, your neighbors and your friends and say, okay, I was talking to a guy the other day, which is a white person. He said, Jim, I know you're a Democrat and I'm a Republican. I'm not going to have a change and you aren't going to change. I said, no, let's not say that. We can work together. Look at the things we got in common and just start. It's going to be a slow process to healing, and it isn't going to happen overnight. But I would think they'll be sworn in, when is it, January the 20th. And take a look at that first 100 days, as they say, which watch what's going to happen then, because then you'll kind of know what's going to go. But in answer to your question, what do I say to them? Number one, appreciate human beings. That's the first thing. Just appreciate. Stop thinking too much about the racial kinds of things and that type of thing. Just try and work. Because divided we fall, as they say, and that's true. And I like Mrs. Clinton approached it, what she was saying, how we can heal. And she said there's strength in togetherness. And I don't have all the answers to how we can best do it, but it can be done.
Well, I really appreciate that honesty and the candor. As so many people said today, thank you very much for your service, your mm-hmm. sacrifices, your contributions. Mm-hmm.
Well, I appreciate what you've done today. You're right there with me. You know that at my age, I'm forgetful. I'm not the sharpest knife at the draw, but I can still cut.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at WVUD.org.